surgical palliative care may seem counterintuitive, but surgeons have a rich history of palliating both their patients and their families. I am Red Hoffman, an acute care surgeon in Asheville, North Carolina, and one of 79 surgeons currently board certified in hospice and palliative medicine. Join me as I interview the founders and the leaders of the surgical palliative care movement, a diverse group of surgeons dedicated to providing high-quality palliative medicine to all surgical and trauma patients. Welcome to the Surgical Palliative Care Podcast. We heal with more than steel.
Hi, everyone. This is Red. My co-host today is Dr. Matt Nielsen. Matt is a urologic oncologist at the UNC Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Thanks for joining us, Matt.
Thanks, Red. It's great to be here.
Matt and I are so honored and excited to be interviewing Dr. Balfour Mont. Bal, as he likes to be called, is also a urologic oncologist and is considered the father of palliative care in North America. Bal, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Oh, it's a pleasure and honor for me. Thank you, both of you.
So, Bal, as we're getting started, can you tell Matt and I a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, where you trained, and how you decided to become a urologist?
Yes, I'm a Canadian, born in Ottawa, and after medical school at Queen's University, I did my residency at McGill in Montreal, and then following that, a fellowship with Willett Whitmore at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York for 2 years. And then came back to McGill as a urologic oncologist and still living in Montreal. And that, I suspect, sums it up.
What drew you specifically to urology?
was interested in a surgical specialty rather than general surgery, was interested in the scope that urology and urologic oncology offers. And and that led me first to urology and then to training at Memorial.
So I read that you were initially influenced by the work of Dr. Kubler-Ross. Can you tell us a little more about that?
In 1972, there was a guest lecturer, and that was Elizabeth, or EKR, as we know her. I had absolutely no idea who she was, but attended and this session and was stunned by the fact that in the largest medical amphitheater at McGill, all seats were taken. There were three or four deep at the back and two or three sitting on each step. So clearly others knew more about her than I did. She had written on death and dying. It was published in 1969. And this was 1972. Elizabeth was one of the most skilled communicators I've ever heard. It was really that lecture that prompted me to think that it would be interesting to do a study of how we handle people with far advanced disease at the Royal Vic. The Royal Victoria Hospital is one of McGill's teaching hospitals. It was then about 1,000 beds. The study we did had 200 respondents, and we documented some 26 deficiencies in the care they were receiving at our hospital, which we were really quite stunned by, because it's a really first-class institution, and there's a lot of pride about the quality of care. And we certainly weren't up to what we thought we were, to the standard that we thought we were. There was significant problems. Out of that, those findings, I shared them with Elizabeth and headed off for London to St. Christopher's Hospice in London, where not Dame Cecily then, but where Cecily Saunders had started this absolutely superb program for caring for people who were terminally ill. And it all progressed from there.
I have chilled listening to that. I feel like we're listening to our history. Thank you.
Well, it's been a very inspiring journey for me, and I feel very fortunate, though it wasn't the journey I thought I would be on.
Looking back, if I'm doing my math right, it seems like you were sort of embarking on this journey really in sort of the prime of your career, in your maybe in your 40s or early 40s, late 30s?
Late 30s.
Late 30s. And so it sounds like that direction was not part of your long-term plan. So for those of our listeners like Red and I who are sort of in a similar phase of life, how did you navigate those changes? It seems like this was something that was really powerful and spoke to you and led you to London. Was that a difficult challenge for you in terms of changing the course of your career?
Well, I certainly enjoyed urologic oncology and the privilege of working with Witt at Memorial. That was just a life-defining experience for sure. So I was very happy as a surgical oncologist at McGill. And this was just one of several studies that I had going. Life became fairly complicated when the findings of the clarification of our deficiencies was evident. As we planned our pilot project at the Royal Vic, pilot project of for a palliative care program started in 1975. And we undertook then to have a program that included a ward, a palliative care unit, consultation service to the active treatment wards of this roughly 1,000-bed hospital, an outpatient clinic, a home care program, and a bereavement follow-up program, as well as research and teaching activities. So it was a rather extensive mandate that we set for ourselves. Meanwhile, I was busy as a surgical oncologist, so it was a busy time and very fulfilling, I guess you'd say. In my first visit to St. Christopher's and getting to know Sicily was in 73, I guess. Then in the summer of 74, Sicily invited me to come back. She and her colleague Tom West, whereas she said, "We shall be birding in Switzerland." I wasn't exactly sure what that meant, but it meant that they were going in search of the birds indigenous to Switzerland.
Oh, my God.
Tom and Sicily left, and I spent the summer with the family at working and living at St. Christopher's. And that was a most rewarding and stimulating time. That then led to the 2-year pilot project at McGill, at the Vic. It all evolved from there. And I remained active as a surgical oncologist for some time, but gradually the palliative care demands and all that was involved in that began to take over.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you came up with the term palliative care?
We had to the idea of having a program in a teaching hospital that was designed for people who were dying was antithetical, I mean, to the goals of the institution. So what to call the program really was an issue. And I thought, well, we'll call it a hospice program. There isn't a snowball's chance in hell that anyone will have heard the term hospice. And so we'll call it a hospice. And to my surprise, our Francophone colleagues said, "Oh my goodness, you can't do that in Quebec, because the term hospice, as used in France at the time, had a very pejorative reputation for a very mediocre kind of care that no one could recommend." So a hospice couldn't be used in Quebec and at McGill. And so then, looking for a term, I thought of palliative as in non-curative, as in palliative radiation therapy, for instance, and then thought palliative care would define quite nicely what we were about.
So, Belle, I'm curious, you know, Dr. Whitmore, unfortunately, I never had a chance to meet him, but I've grown up hearing really sort of inspiring things about him from many of the leaders in our field. And I'm curious what his reaction was to this direction your career took, and in general, how your surgical colleagues received your interest and whether they were supportive of that.
Whit was, first of all, I need to say, probably, I was going to say, the most fully rounded Olympic stature human that I think I've met. He was a man of great intelligence and insight. He was a superb surgeon. He was had broad interests and was always pleasant, generally smiling. But he was at the same time very frank. And he had a pleasant way of telling you that pleasant isn't a straightforward, but acceptable and gentle almost way, well, gentle is not right, of telling you that you'd steered the train off the tracks. he was an excellent surgeon. When I left at the end of the fellowship, he invited me to come back and to stay at Memorial. And as you can imagine, Matt, that was a very
huge honor.
A great privilege. And but I had other quite considerable ties at McGill. And Whit was... he had such an active and mind, and was progressive and positive. He was interested in, of course, in the career change, or that certainly initially it was a project that I was involved in. And I don't remember any... any ever comment of his that wasn't reinforcement of anything that led to growth in healthcare, and it certainly wasn't what we had initially thought would be happening. He understood that. And it was sympathetic, and in some ways already looked at surgical oncology as calling forth and having concern for the therapeutic triad of patient, family members, and caregivers as a dynamic unit, triad. He was very conscious of that. It wasn't about him. It was about the process. He was, in his own way, very aware and attended to what we would come to think of as whole person care with... pathophysiology and the physical prominent, but with psychological, social, and existential / spiritual concerns essential for quality care. And so all of that was second nature in a way to for Witt. But he wouldn't have articulated it quite like that. But it was the way he was. He was a giant.
Did you find that once you started the palliative care service that surgeons in your hospital were referring patients to you or were consulting you?
Yeah. When we had the pilot project, which was 1975 and 76, that two-year period, it was a time of great fiscal tightening of budgets and pressure on beds. I mean, it's always like that, I realize. But it was certainly like that at the Vic then. So there was a great deal of resentment from my colleagues about the program. These were teaching beds. These were research beds. This was in an underfunded teaching hospital, and so it was a very busy, high output teaching hospital. So the idea of doing this was, in the eyes of many, bordering on the bizarre, because as we can recall, and as is still the case, academic institutions, medical teaching hospitals, are for investigating, diagnosing, prolonging life, and curing, and to squander the all too thinly spread beds on such nonsense as what came to be called palliative care. They should be cared for, was the thought of the day at in nursing homes or somewhere else, and it's bless you, my son, but don't do it at our hospital. And
right.
That was the preeminent theme, really. And this was tough. I mean, it was there were no other programs in any academic center, medical school, anywhere in the world that had done this. Or I don't say that. That's just fact. And so there was nothing one could turn to. Certainly, I had and have every respect for Cicely's excellence in making St. Christopher's a center of academic excellence, no question. But she didn't do it in a teaching hospital with all the pressures on academic centers of excellence.
So, Val, I'm curious, as you embarked on this program with the pilot and your work with Dame Saunders and others, you were still maintaining early on your busy practice in urologic oncology, and could you reflect for us a little bit on sort of how that affected your approach to your patients or your practice over time?
I think it had a great effect, and I went into such detail about my own health issues to reflect that they also were helpful, and it wasn't hard for me to imagine what people were going through. Yes, I'm sure it always is not understandable what the guy beside you is going through, and that's clear, but having been a patient and a family member and caregiver, in other words, all parts of that therapeutic triad, has been helpful, I think. And I'm just in awe of the potential of the human spirit, and the potential of for grace and for we can make a difference when we can do a cystectomy and ileal conduit urinary diversion or retroperitoneal lymph node dissection and chemotherapy and whatever. We can make a huge difference. But we can make just as striking a difference, if not more striking, because of the battlefield in which it's being played. When we taking part in helping people who are at the end of life, challenges are peculiar to that setting, but the rewards are certainly there in spades.
I think it's so lovely. We talk about that idea of just sitting with patients and kind of just the difference that even just sitting on the bed and holding hands can make. But I think it's so lovely to hear those words coming from someone who's a surgeon, because the reality is we can make such a difference with what we do in the operating room, but it's so important to remember as surgeons how much a difference we can make just sitting and holding space for someone. And it's, I think, especially for trainees, sometimes so easy to overlook that because they're so busy trying to acquire all the skills and excellence you need to save someone's life, but it's so important to remember. So thank you for that reminder.
I found it challenging to slow down and to do just what you said, Red, to realize that if you just sit there and hold a hand, you'll be amazed at what may unfold. Palliative care entails such a spectrum of input that's so different from the therapeutic equation that that we have as surgeons, you know.
Val, when we're talking about palliative care, especially, you know, we talk about it now, we talk a lot about the importance of an interdisciplinary team. But I'm wondering, when you started, did you have a full complement of providers as a team with you, like nurses and social workers and a chaplain, or were you mostly by yourself?
Oh, well, no. For the 2-year pilot project, we had the full ball of wax, including, I mean, all of those you mentioned, but as an example of that comes to mind, because it made the cover of the Canadian Medical a photograph in the cover of the Canadian Medical Association journal, then was that it occurred to me that since we are so responsive as a species to music, what about a music therapist? Well, that sounded totally crazy to be unwashed. But I, through a personal experience, had met a couple of very highly trained music therapists, So we had as part of the team not only a psychologist or psychiatrist and nurses and very well-trained, superbly trained volunteer program and rigorous. They had reading lists they had to have read, and they had interviews and continuing education programs and stuff. The volunteers were incredible. And, of course, that was a problem because that caused friction with the nurses. So, you know, it's the same old in
right.
some ways. But but into that mix, you're throwing a what? A music therapist? What is that, you know? So, yes, we sure had a very well-rounded, multidisciplinary team, I can tell you. And we were very fortunate to have pulled that off because we learned a lot of lessons. We learned a lot of lessons about the fact that we really are physical, psychological, social, and spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not just romantic garbly guck. That's just the way it is. And if you leave out one of those domains, and leave out one of those domains on the team, and as you know, this existential spiritual domain is the one that, in my experience, gets left out most, because who in the world even understands what that is, what's involved there? If you play lip service, oh, yeah, well, at our hospital, we do have a chaplain, you know. That doesn't cut it. You need to have somebody who's really, really has a profound and deep understanding of the issues that we all share in that domain. You know, as a surgical oncologist, I was pretty interested in cutting out the problem, and it was always both surprising and exciting to see the rich mix of all these domains that we have, whether we're in health or illness or and actually dying. Does any of that make any sense at all?
Oh yeah,
this is great.
I could listen to you talk all day, honestly.
Could I get you just to record that for my wife?
I'll send you the whole recording and she can listen.
Yeah,
to
that's right. Yeah. Okay.
Well, thank you so much, Belle, for this really, really great conversation. I know on behalf of Red and I and all of our listeners, I mean, this is just priceless. I'm curious if you have any thoughts about sort of the most important next steps or future directions for the field to make the most of where you've launched this over the past 40 years. Where should we be, you know, aiming our ship for the next 40 years?
Matt, I think my fundamental concern from, and it's just speaking from perspective, my superficial knowledge of the day-to-day experience of, I'm thinking of two or three programs that I know about. Excellence. Sicily didn't attempt to start a movement, or she didn't have her sights set on a global or defining a career path or a new field of care. That wasn't her sight. She kept her sight fixed on the particular individual that whose bedside she was sitting beside. That sounds corny, but it's the point being that I think the biggest challenge, and it's an immense challenge in all programs of palliative care, is to keep looking back at to basics, to begin to understand the contemplative domain, the contemplative process that is fundamentally that fundamentally defines how we, whether we're patients, family members, or caregivers, how we experience health and illness. What I'm struggling to try and express is that the success of a program and the goals for the future, I think, should be the same goals Cecily had. The basic thought and concern should always be with that one person you're with at a deep level. And of course, that kind of talk sounds light or romantic or fuzzy and fluffy. It's not. It's tough, and it's sharp-edged, and it's profoundly important. So what I think, if we all began to understand the contemplative dimension of presence to one another, that would be a place to start. Whatever our global dreams or professional aspirations as a field, that they're all sort of beside the point. What really is important is what she or he, whose hand I'm holding and sitting there listening to, what is their inner journey at this particular moment. And there's so much to think about, isn't there? It isn't about enforcing my view of the interview journey. And that's always the danger, of course. And it really takes depth listening and depth presence, radical presence, as I like to call it, to get past my own preoccupations and fantasies about what he or she needs, and to really, really understand as much as one can the nature of their needs in all those, or and not needs, the nature of their situation in each of those domains.
That's such a great reminder. Thank you. Val, as we're getting ready to wrap up, I'm wondering, is there anything else you'd like to share with us? I know you've shared so much already.
I just applaud what you're doing, and I'm writing the last 10 years I've been writing an autobiography that really is the my memory of the path that palliative care has had over the past decades. And has been a wonderful project for me, because it's been an acute reminder of the richness that's there for anyone who becomes interested in this field.
I just want to thank you so much, Val, for talking with us today. I have to say, personally, as both a palliative care physician, but especially as a surgeon, I'm so honored to have learned more about you. And I just want to express my deepest gratitude for all the work you've done and for the very rich legacy that you've bestowed upon the surgical palliative care community. Obviously, we wouldn't be here without your work and your vision, and it's just been an honor to get to hear your story. Thank you.
Echo that. Thank you, Belle. It really has just been amazingly inspiring from someone who is already a hero to just get to know you and hear it in your own words has really been terrific. So thank you so much.
Well, I forget how much I had to pay you to say all that, but I'll send along my last installment in the fee right away. And all good wishes to you, Red, and to you, Matt. It's been fun to chat. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Bell. Have a great
okay.
day.
Bye for now. Bye.
Okay. Take care.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Surgical Palliative Care Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to stay up to date on the latest episodes. To learn more about the surgical palliative care community, follow us on Twitter at SurgePalCare. If you'd like to get more involved with the Surgical Palliative Care social media team, please reach out on Twitter or via email at surgicalpalliativecare@gmail.com. Lastly, take good care of yourselves and take good care of each other.